Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
I think for me to go out and be who I am and play as true to the game and as hard as I can and try to lead this team is who I am, not anybody else. I'm not Michael, I'm not Ali, I'm not nobody else. Done so many great things for sport. I am who I am. You know, if I'm able to go out and put together a game like that, it wasn't because I was possessed. It's because I've worked on my craft all season long, and, you know, that's the result of it.
It's going to be a great atmosphere. Our fans are unbelievable, and I can't wait to get out there tonight. I'm going to do whatever it takes to help our team win this ball game. Man, I got to do a job of trying to get my guys some looks. When I attract a double team or I attract guys in transition to get those guys going, it's 50-50. Those guys have to get themselves going as well.
What changes for you guys if Kevin is not able?
Next man up.
He has to make sharp, quick moves, and he understands that. But we need Kyrie to be aggressive. So he's a scorer. He's a special player. He has the best handle in the NBA, so he's able to play ISO basketball. But he's got to make quick decisions, and he understands that.
The only thing this way is going to go is if, you know, myself and Brown, we have to will our ways to their defense. You know, they're doing a lot of switching, a lot of things that to make us uncomfortable, which we haven't necessarily seen throughout the season. So for us, it's just about preparation.
We're not born to hostile environments, especially this year, everywhere we went. You know, it's been crazy. You know, it's been sold out everywhere we went. Everybody, fans are super loud, you know, with the season that we're having. So, you know, we just got to come in here with the even greater focus than we had at home and block the crowd out as much as you can.
You know, you think about this playoff series, the Houston series, I didn't play. We still had a legit chance in the last 2 minutes to get that job done. So that was kind of just a missed opportunity. Portland series kind of the same way. And then last series, we just got dismantled in 3 and 4 on the road. And it was more a situation where we kind of beat ourselves with turnovers. The details of the game plan that we knew we needed to correct, we hope we can figure that out for tomorrow. This is a hostile environment for sure, and one that we remember from last year.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, that's what it is. Welcome to the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Apologies for the scratchy pipes. The change in weather, whatever it is, hot to cold to cool to mild, it always seems to mess around with my system. So if I start to sound a little bit less than normal, it's not your speakers, it's me. My apologies right at the outset. It's going to be, excuse me, almost all about game number 3 tonight between the Cavaliers and the Warriors in game 3 of the NBA Finals today. Yesterday we did our level best to avoid a lot of finals talk. We just needed a break. Don't you agree, Kush?
Oh, yeah.
Not just finals, but the playoffs, going all the way back to the start of the playoffs when the Pistons and the Cavaliers opened things up as a 1-versus-8 first-round matchup. We have just been so NBA playoff heavy. I think yesterday was a good day to take that break.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt about it. We got some baseball talk in, some other things, and it's definitely, you got to take those breaks every now and again, and the schedule afforded it because as the NBA Finals with their schedule, it's there's 2 days when there's travel like this. That's why that's why game 3 is today, but game 4 is actually Friday because they're not changing venue. So it was a nice break for a day.
Yeah, you kind of have to too. I mean, especially when you're talking about long travel, the whole thing about jet lag and the impact and effect on the bodies for all these guys, both teams obviously. When you're going to from Cleveland to Oakland, and you're talking about 2,200 miles or whatever it is in difference. If this was Indiana against Dallas in the finals, East versus West, it's probably not that necessary to have 2 full
right.
days off. But in this case, obviously it is, and this is just what they do. So, it did afford us an opportunity yesterday to take the day off from talking about the NBA Finals, but it is game day now. And the question is, do the Cavaliers have enough pride? Do they have enough intestinal fortitude to stand their ground and hold their ground at home after watching the Warriors so impressively take care of business on their own home floor, as they should, as the favorite, as the 73-win team from the regular season? They should have taken care of business in games 1 and 2. Now, should and would the margin of victory have been as enormous as that under normal circumstances? Absolutely not. 48 points to the negative for the Cavaliers in the first two games, an NBA record for the first two games of any finals. That's embarrassing, which is why my question tonight isn't, do the Cavaliers have what it takes to beat the Golden State Warriors? My question for tonight in Game 3 is, do they have enough pride to step up and stand up to the Western Conference bully that, quite frankly, has owned them? Now 7 straight victories going back to last year's finals, the 2 regular season games, and now these first two, 7 straight victories that the Warriors have over the Cavaliers. Some of them have been ugly, as we just talked about in the last one. And guess what? It's time to step up and show some pride. And I'm going to just come right out and say it bluntly. It's time for LeBron James to step up and claim what he says is his. If he truly is still the best player in basketball, if he truly is still striving for a spot on Mount Rushmore, if he truly is the champion that he proclaims as a king, King James to be, it is time for LeBron James to step up and lead. Not to distribute the ball evenly and make sure that JR gets his looks and that Kyrie Irving gets his looks and Kevin Love, who will not play tonight, we'll talk about that in a minute, you know, that they all have an equal role in this. No. Now is the time for LeBron James to get selfish and to be efficient. And let me explain what I mean by that. If you look at what LeBron did in Game 1, if you look at what LeBron did, quite frankly, in a lot of the games, even the ones that they won in the first 3 rounds in the playoffs in the Eastern Conference, LeBron James was a very, very unselfish facilitator of the basketball, of the offense. He was very content to set other people up and kind of make the offense go. He fed everybody for jump shots, for drives, for post-up moves, etc. And that's fine. No problem with that. But there comes a time, there really does come a time, when a superstar has to be the superstar. There comes a time where you can't just be the facilitator. You have got to take things over on your own. And that time is now for LeBron James. The problem is, I think he realized it was that time in Game 2. He wasn't trying to be as unselfish and as much of the facilitator, the playmaker, the ball distributor. He was trying to step up and take over. But the problem was, as he'll readily admit, he just didn't have it. He just didn't have it. He was missing shots. He was turning the ball over, finished the game with 8 or 9 turnovers. Just did not have it. So LeBron James acknowledging that when he tried to take over, he didn't take over, and he really needed to take over. And now you have the number of NBA stars and NBA legends, icons, if you will, saying it's time for LeBron James to step up and again claim what he says is his. And that is the mantle of greatest player. Lead your team to a finals victory. Lead your team in a must-win situation to a must-win victory. This is the opportunity that he should be relishing. And no less than the great Phil Jackson, who of course coached Michael Jordan and all of the Bulls championship teams, who of course coached Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal to 3 championships. Phil Jackson said the time is now for LeBron James to be more Jordan-esque. Those were his words, more Jordan-esque. You heard LeBron James. Jim, I don't know if you can isolate that cut in your intro from your montage, but you heard him say, I can't try to be anybody else. I can't try to be something I'm not. He said, I can't be Jordan. I can't be Muhammad Ali. I'm just going to be me and do the things that I do. But the bottom line is, when somebody says Jordan-esque, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to play just like Mike, but we need the results like Mike got in his 6 finals appearances, his 6 MVPs. You need to be Jordan-esque in your, not necessarily your style of play. You need to be that way in the result here. in the point production, in the will to carry your team to victory. You need to be doing that. And that's something that I don't know if LeBron James is ready to and maybe will ever be ready to embrace. Listen to what he said.
I think for me to go out and be who I am and play as true to the game and as hard as I can and try to lead this team is who I am, not anybody else. I'm not Michael. I'm not Ali. I'm not nobody else. Done so many great things for sport. I am who I am. You know, if I'm able to go out and put together a game like that, it wasn't because I was possessed. It's because I've worked on my craft all season long, and, you know, that's the result of it.
I don't know what to make of that, to be honest with you. I kind of look, I'm trying to be positive. I'm trying to be motivated. I'm trying to look for the silver lining of an 0-2 deficit, knowing that there is something that can be brought out in game three that has not been brought out in the first two games. And I would love to hear my star, my team's best player, the 4-time MVP and the 2-time previous champion. I would love to hear him say, absolutely, I'm going to take it up a notch. I need to take it up a notch. I agree. I'm going to go and do some of these things that the greatest of all time have done. Great players rise up in big situations, in must-win games, in NBA Finals series. I intend to be just that tonight. That's what I'm looking for. And instead, again, Phil Jackson, using the words Michael Jordan, saying that LeBron James must be more Jordan-esque is something that LeBron, instead of embracing, has kind of rejected, has kind of bristled at. If you didn't hear it, Phil Jackson said this of the Cavaliers situation, down 0-2. He was kind of comparing it a little bit to 1993, how his Bulls, Michael Jordan, trailing in the Eastern Conference Finals, to trailing the New York Knicks 0-2. They were down 2-0 in 93. And Jordan was motivated by a New York Times article, said Phil Jackson, that negatively reported on his off-day trip to an Atlantic City casino, criticizing him as perhaps not being locked in, focused. The Bulls won 4 straight after that article ran. Jordan scored 32.2 points per game in the series. And Jackson compared that to LeBron James' situation with Game 3 tonight, saying, quote, it did something to Michael Jordan. You learn something about pulling the cape of Superman. It's not a good idea. He was a man possessed after that. I think it's going to take something for LeBron to step into that, put his cape on and say, I'm going to have to take over a lot of this series, doing the things beyond my level or my normal capacity. He's been a team player up to this point, and I think he's going to have to step beyond that. End quote. I don't know how that's possible to disagree with. If he is only going to take 21 or 22 shots, and he's going to continue to, you know, defer to other guys. And again, we're not saying he should not use his other talent. There's a reason Kyrie is there. There's a reason why, even though J.R. Smith seems very, very reluctant to really fully aggressively try to do his thing on offense, these guys have certain roles to play. But at the end of the day, you know, Scottie Pippen was an all-timer, one of the 50 greatest players ever. He was is a Hall of Famer, but he was a role player, if you will, on that team. In other words, he could dominate from time to time, like much like Kyrie can, and even Love can. But when it came time to dominate in a must-win situation, it was time for him to play his role. It was time for him, and it was time for everybody else on the roster with the superstar to play the role, but get out of the way while the superstar did what needed to be done. And that is what Phil Jackson is saying. And that is what LeBron James is obviously disagreeing with. He's saying, I can't try to be anybody else. I'm just going to be me. What does it actually mean? What does it actually mean to go out there and try to be Jordan or try to be Ali or any of those other things he's talking about? He said, Phil is a great coach and Michael was a great player, but I am who I am. And that's really, really interesting. He's right. He can't be those guys. He can't be anybody but who he is. But Phil Jackson is spot on in my mind. Phil Jackson is spot on in that he's saying that he needs to find a way to be as dominant as those kinds of guys. Well, Phil actually brought up Mike. LeBron brought up Muhammad Ali, obviously, at this time as well. So game three tonight, whether you want to believe it or not, it is indeed, and some people don't. Some people bristle at the suggestion that LeBron James' legacy is on the line. Some people say that's absolutely uncalled for. It's unfair, and it's not true that his legacy is on the line. But I will say this, and I had this disagreement with Maniloff earlier this week. If you are 2-4 in the finals and in danger of falling to 2-5, not in a hard-fought seven-game series, but if you are in danger of falling to 2-5 in NBA finals by getting blown out in 3, 4, 5 games out of the 4 or 5 that it's going to take to win the series, and that's the way you go out in this one, it is a legacy-defining moment. Because Mike never had this happen to him in any series, whether they were the favorites or not the favorites. Magic, even when he lost in the finals, remember, Magic was 5-4 in 9 NBA finals. In none of the 4 did he just get completely rolled. Actually, that's not true. I take that back. 1983, when the Sixers were on their unbelievable march to the championship, when Moses Malone, going into the playoffs, famously predicted fo-fo-fo, and they lost one game in the conference finals to Milwaukee, so it turned out to be fo-fi-fo, he and they swept the Lakers in 1983. So there was one of those years that Magic and the Lakers did get embarrassed, in a manner of speaking. But again, this is a guy who's legacy was written with 9 finals appearances, 5-4 in those. And that sweep at the hands of the Sixers was one of those. LeBron would be, if this happens this way, 2-5 in NBA finals, and no matter who you are. What is the old adage? Your record says you're only as good as your record says you are. And right now, it is entirely possible that LeBron James' record is going to be 2-5, and that he may only be as good as that record says he is. And again, you know, let's be honest. Everybody has their own opinion. But this is a guy who himself brought up the Mount Rushmore conversation a couple of seasons ago and said, I will knock somebody off of that Mount Rushmore by the time I'm done. You get blown out in a series like this when you have full strength, and I know Kevin Love is not playing tonight, but a lot of people feel like that might be a blessing in disguise. But you get knocked out at a time like this, in a manner like this, yeah, it's going to leave a big, big mark on that legacy. And that's something that even Skip Bayless was talking about this morning. And I want to kind of see if I can share that with you. I've told you before, I like the ESPN programming. I love Mike and Mike in the Morning. You hear every day right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. I also like some of the TV programs. And this is something that I do watch and listen to from time to time. And see if you agree with this on the legacy of LeBron.
This is the most important game of LeBron James' career, because to me, his legacy is teetering tonight at home in Game 3. The way he's going to go down in NBA history, the way he will be remembered, will be in maybe large part dictated by how he performs tonight, with the eyes of the sports world on him, wondering, waiting to see how LeBron will play, because of the way he played, or let me say, didn't play, didn't show up in games 1 and 2 in Oakland. I think he has a great shot, a great opportunity with the eyes of the sports world on him to turn this thing around, to come out in attack mode, to set an early intimidating tone of not in my house, to show us and show his teammates that he can lead this team to a Game 3 win, which, by the way, in my book, could easily lead to a Game 4 win. And then, in the big picture, even if they did get this to a Game 7 at Oracle, and I know most people are saying right now, that's a crazy thought, but if they did, even if they lost in Game 7 at Oracle, we're giving LeBron a big pass. In fact, you could say that he would actually gain respect falling to 2-5 in the finals if he could win tonight and win Friday night. If LeBron James gets swept here and falls to 2-5, that will look all-time bad. And if he doesn't show up for either of these two games in Cleveland, I think people will start making the case that this meltdown or no-show was even worse on LeBron's legacy than that 2011 finals, in which the chosen one became the frozen one in losing to the Dallas Mavericks.
All right, we'll stop it there because that's the discussion now. From the standpoint of two things, one, LeBron's legacy, which should mean nothing to people who are just interested in their team. If you happen to be a Cavaliers fan, you do, to just win this thing for the franchise, for the city. But that is a big thing for LeBron. The second thing is indeed for the series because they go hand in hand. Let's be honest. They're not going to win. They're not going to beat a team that has beat them seven times in a row if they're carried by Kyrie. They are not going to beat a team tonight in game three against a team with 73 wins that has beaten them in the first two by a combined 48, that has beaten them overall seven times in a row, if they have to be carried by J.R. Smith or by Tristan Thompson or by a hot Channing Frye. Obviously, I'm skipping over Kevin Love because he's out tonight. They're only going to beat a team that has beaten them seven times in a row and make this a series again if they are carried by the King, if they are carried by LeBron James. The time is now for him to step up and be what he has proclaimed himself to be, that he is indeed the best player in the NBA, the guy that everyone fears. No matter what you think about Steph Curry being the MVP, as he pointed out, there's a difference between being the most valuable player and being the best player. It is time to prove that. Be more valuable than Steph. Be better than Steph. Be better than Clay. Be better than the team that has beaten you seven straight times. It is indeed the only way. The problem for LeBron James going into this game three tonight is indeed that he just can't rely on any kind of a go-to move that doesn't involve driving to the basket and meeting up with Andrew Bogut or the swiping hands of Andre Iguodala or Klay Thompson or Harrison Barnes or anybody else who is waiting inside, because they're all camping there just saying, come on in, King. Bring it in here. Let's have some contact. We're going to swipe. Sometimes we're going to pick your pocket. Sometimes you're going to score. And sometimes we're going to foul you. And then we're going to take our chances with you at the line not being a great foul shooter. In other words, if LeBron doesn't have a jump shot, and so far in this playoff and so far in this season, he has not had a jump shot, it's going to be that much harder for him to be what he needs to be. And that's exactly the point that Brian Windhorst made when he talked to Mike and Mike this morning about game three.
We all know that LeBron is the one whose legacy is at stake here and everything else. Should he / could he be doing much more than he's doing right now?
I think he's inhibited right now because he doesn't trust his jump shot. And everybody in the league knows he doesn't trust his jump shot, and so they back off of him. They've been backing off of him since the Pistons series. And he's had games where he's made it. But if you look at his numbers this year, he shot the worst 3-point percentage since he was 20 years old. His jump shot numbers are way down. And in the second half of the season, he recognized that. And so you know what he did? He stopped taking them. He just went to the basket. He won Player of the Month in February, March, and April, going to the basket. And in this series, where has he gotten it done? Going to the basket. Problem is, the Warriors know that. So they're putting two guys on him. They know when he goes in there that he's not going to pass. He's going to probably shoot. So they're rotating Bogut and Azeli and everybody, and they're blocking him at the rim. And occasionally he is getting through and getting those dunks and layups. But because they know they don't have to respect the jumper like they have in years past, like he threw the dagger right through the Spurs' heart in that series, Popovich tried the same thing. And he was like, not anymore, Greg. I gotcha. And he checkmated him in that series in 2013. Just totally beat him with the jumper. For whatever reason, LeBron's jumper has not been the same this year, and he knows it, and he's affected the way he plays. So I don't know if he has the capability to score 40 in the same way he's had in years past. I promise you, when this season is over, LeBron's going to spend the whole summer shooting jumpers. He will not let that jumper, whatever happened to it in the last year, go away, and he'll get it better by next season, but next season is far away.
In game number two, the game in which they lost by 33 points, LeBron James, outside of 5 feet, was 5 for 14. And that has been typical of what his jump shot has done, exactly like Brian Windhorst said. I don't think it's possible even to argue that. We're going to discuss that with Rick Noland at 4:05 today as we prepare for Game 3 of the NBA Finals. Want to know if you think the Cavaliers can win and will win, and if they do, will it be the last win that they get in this series? Yesterday, we talked with somebody who said, you know what, as much as I love him, as much as we want to see him do well, this is probably going to be a five-game series. It's probably going to be they'll get Game 3, the Warriors will rebound and correct whatever fell apart in Game 3 and win Game 4 and then win it on their home court in Game number 5. Is that what's coming? Time will tell. But we're going to talk about that with Rick Noland at 4:05 and hopefully with you as well. But coming up right after this, we get a SportsCenter timeout here. We're going to shift gears and talk Tigers baseball with Anthony Fenech, our good friend from the Detroit Free Press, who is covering those Tigers as they play. Where are they? In about the 7th inning right now, Jim Cushlin?
8th inning right now. 7-2 Toronto leads this one.
7-2 Toronto. And we're going to get an update. Yesterday we talked at length about the AL Central with Zach Meisel from Cleveland. Today we'll talk more about it and the Tigers with Anthony Fenech of the Free Press in Detroit. So all of that coming up. And then again, more back to more baseball talk, right? Or I'm sorry, NBA Finals talk right here on ESPN 106.5 The Team.
Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
It is indeed. The extravaganza rolls on. It's 3:39. Want to shift gears, get away from the NBA Finals for just a bit, talk a little more baseball. Yesterday, we had a pretty in-depth conversation on the American League Central now being led by the first-place Cleveland Indians with Zach Meisel from Cleveland. And now we turn our attention to the Tigers, who, quite frankly, not having a good afternoon. Jordan Zimmermann has been rocked. 2 home runs allowed, 2 triples, 2 doubles, and 2 singles. Holy cow, it's the double cycle against Jordan Zimmermann in less than 5 innings. 7-2 the score right now in the middle of the 8th inning. And joining us now to talk about it is Anthony Fenech, our good friend from the Detroit Free Press, covering those Tigers. Anthony, how are you, sir?
Pretty good. Just enjoying a little bit of an off day, getting some things done for the draft tomorrow, getting some things ready for. I'm going to New York over the weekend, but so I haven't really watched today's game. But yeah, Zimmermann, his line looks pretty rough.
Yeah, I mean he's apparently having an off day too. If we can go ahead and use it that way. 8 hits, 7 runs, all of them earned, 2 walks and 3 strikeouts, and 4 2/3 his ERA now, 3.30. Obviously, still very solid in that regard. But this is a bit of a setback. Have you ever seen a double cycle like that before against a pitcher? Giving up 2 singles, 2 doubles, 2 triples, and 2 homers, that's an unusual statistic.
That is. I don't think I've ever seen that. He's kind of struggled a little bit his last he had the right groin, a little bit of a hiccup there. But the last couple starts, he hasn't looked quite as sharp as he was the first month of the season. I think with Zimmermann, I don't think he's as good as the first month of the season was, but I definitely don't think he's as bad as the last few starts have been. I think he's probably somewhere in the middle, a little bit closer to the good side. I mean, I think he's a legitimate number two pitcher, a guy that's, they can just count on every 5th day. But I think one of the things that's a little bit concerning is the home runs against allowed to right-handers, because right-handers are really kind of touching him up a little bit. He's allowed a lot of home runs here recently. He allowed a lot of home runs last year with the Nationals. So I think it's something to look at going forward.
Anthony Fenech, our guest, talking a little American League Central baseball, talking Tigers baseball. Again, Tigers getting rocked today, but they have won 5 in a row coming into today. Record 2 games over 500, and it seems like only yesterday we were on Ausmus watch. How bright is that spotlight? How hot is that seat? Whatever you want to say about it. And it just seems like, you know, that was a long time ago. It seems like yesterday, but it also seems like a long time ago because things have gotten right or gone right. What exactly is the key to the turnaround? And do you think that this is exactly what we can expect, Anthony, for the remainder or the bulk of the remainder of the season, at least until the trade deadline, that we're going to see these teams, you know, there's 4 of them there, not counting the Twins, all within about 2.5, 3.5 games of each other, just kind of, nip and tuck, give and take a little bit the rest of the way?
Yeah, that's what I think is going to happen. It would surprise me if one of these teams really kind of separated themselves from the pack. If it was going to be one of those teams, I would feel like it'd be the Tigers, just because I think that on paper they have the most talent of any of the 4 teams. I really think, though, I mean, I really think the Indians got something going on good there. They just got a vibe about them. They play fun. They're They got really good starting pitching. They're getting enough offense from guys like Mike Napoli. So I really think the Indians might be the best
team. Our mutual friend Zach Meisel, I asked
him. Zach Meisel, who likes ice cream, by the way.
As I've been told, yes. I asked him almost the same question yesterday, and it's interesting. You said that the Tigers could very well be the team if anybody does do it because they have more talent than everybody, which is one approach. His was the opposite approach. He said he thinks that all of these teams are flawed, but that the one team that might pull away if anybody does, it's going to be the least flawed team, not the most talented, but the least flawed. And obviously those are very different things. And he thinks that of all of the teams, of the four, that it might be the Indians. You said they've got a vibe. He said they might have the fewest flaws. They don't have as much talent as everybody, but they have fewer flaws.
I think that's a good point. I would still lean on the side of talent because I think what we're seeing over here the past, you know, 5-6 games of the Tigers is that their talent, guys like Justin Upton, he's finally starting to turn the corner. You know, Michael Fulmer, he's just been ridiculous the last four outings. I think you can see what this team can do when their talent is playing at a high level, which it is right now. I mean, outside of today, they're just getting beat pretty bad today.
Sure.
But I definitely still think the Tigers are a flawed team. I still think the bullpen's a little bit shaky. You know, if Zimmerman can't straighten this out, well, then you have another question at the top of the starting rotation. And really, the one thing they can't afford is to be answering any questions with, you know, Justin Verlander and Jordan Zimmerman. As the summer wears on, we're going to see what the Tigers are going to do about this innings limit, about 160, 170 innings with Fulmer, because if he keeps going out there every fifth day, he's certainly going to be pushing up against that in, you know, August and September. So, I think all of these teams are flawed. And I've said from the start, I don't think the American League Central is a very good division. I think there's, you know, four teams that are mediocre to, like, above average teams here. I think, like I said, the Tigers, they have a lot of talent. I mean, you just look at that lineup. It's a ridiculous lineup. It's a ridiculous collection of veteran power hitters, guys that can hit the ball out of the park. And I think that I've always thought that as the summer goes on and as the temperatures get hotter, they're going to eat up on mediocre pitching. And baseball season's a roller coaster, so I don't think that any one of these teams is going to separate themselves. It should be a good race, and it should make for an interesting trade deadline as you've got all these teams kind of looking at which way to go.
And Anthony, you know, Jim Kushlin here, and I'm thinking about this too. You were talking about some of the talent level, and you're right, especially on the offensive side. But long haul, I'm starting to be worried about some of this starting pitching, especially because I agree with you, some of the bullpen flaws are still there, though they don't feel as severe as in the last couple of years. But, you know, you mentioned maybe this is just a bad outing for Zimmerman, but we've already seen this team demote Anibal Sanchez to the bullpen. You mentioned the pitch, maybe innings limit down the line for Michael Fulmer, outstanding rookie season for him. We talked about Verlander in the past, and then you got some other guys like Mike Pelfrey, who it took until this calendar flipped to June for him to get win number one, and he had a decent year in Minnesota, thought he could be an innings eater, and then, you know, you have the trade deadline later. How do they straighten this out, or is there a possible move coming if certain things keep performing like this?
Well, they were pretty hamstrung here with the James Shields, the White Sox traded for James Shields because they don't have the kind of payroll where they can just add a big a $10-12 million guy anymore. And doubling down on that, they don't really want to part with any of their prospects or cost controlled prospects, which I think nearing the trade deadline, if they have to make a move to get a back end starter or another bullpen guy, they're gonna have to give up one of these prospects they don't want. So I don't expect it to be, you know, like a Matt Boyd or a Daniel Norris, but when in talking about the starting rotation, I think that's where Boyd and Norris and a little bit of this rotation depth they didn't have last year, I think that's where it comes into play. Like you said, there are still some questions with the rotation, and right now it starts with Pelfrey. I mean, you would have told me on June 8th that the Tigers would be a 500 team without Anibal Sanchez in their starting rotation. I would have said no way. And to me, it's still a little bit confusing to see how they're going to compete without Sanchez, because going into the season, he was my X factor. He was going to need to pitch like a frontline kind of pitcher, and now he's in the bullpen, $16.8 million in the bullpen as a long reliever. But so far, they've weathered the storm, and they've weathered the storm without guys like Justin Upton hitting to his potential, James McCann and Jose Iglesias. They've struggled, but they seem to be coming on the way back. So, they have questions in the rotation, but I think if they get the production that they expect out of Verlander, Zimmerman, and now Fulmer, and keep in mind, Fulmer's a rookie, all right? I mean, I know people are putting a lot of expectations on him right now, but he's a rookie. Boyd's a second-year pitcher. When Norris comes up, he's going to be a second-year pitcher. So these are young pitchers who are not fully developed. So it's going to be hard to put put those kind of expectations and that kind of weight on their shoulders.
We're talking to Anthony Fenech, who covers the Tigers for the Detroit Free Press. Bob France and Jim Cushlin is here as well. You know, you said that nobody's going to really pull away in this division. I don't disagree. Somebody could fall away, though, and make this a three-team race, really, than a more than a four-team race. And, of course, I'm speaking of the White Sox. They had the second-best record in baseball for about a month and a half. They have now lost for the 19th time yesterday, for the 19th time in their last 25. They are 6-19, have just fallen off the reservation. And they just made the big move, of course, for James Shield. It's a gamble. James Shields is a gamble. It could be a big benefit. You know, obviously, we don't expect trade acquisitions and that sort of thing until much closer to the end of July when we get to the deadline. But what happened to the White Sox, do you think?
I just, like I've been saying, you know, throughout the first couple months, I couldn't buy him yet, and then all of a sudden they started falling off the face of the earth. There just always seemed to be something wrong with the brew there, and I think it kind of started with Robin Ventura. I don't think very highly of him as a manager. I don't think that I don't really think he's the right man, and I think that if this keeps spiraling out of control, like we just went through the off-season watch, there's going to be a Ventura watch at some point, because the White Sox, off-season after off-season, they keep putting in more resources into the team, and then they just made this move with James Shields, which I think was a good move. I mean, Shields obviously has his warts. I mean, he's a fly ball pitcher now. He's going to U.S. Cellular, where he's had some home run issues in the past, even at Petco Park, and now he's going to a smaller park. But I still think James Shields is the kind of guy to take the ball every fifth day. He's a bulldog in the mound. We all know about the big game James nickname, but I think he's a veteran pitcher who helps out that starting rotation. The only problem is I don't think the starting rotation is what needed beefing up. I mean, I think that offense has some issues. Abreu really hasn't been playing up to his full potential. And believe it or not, they miss Adam LaRosa's left-handed bat a little bit. So I would agree with you in saying that the White Sox, if any of these teams have fall out of the race, it's going to be them. But I still don't think they're going to fall out of the race. I think like we hear on a daily basis from Brad Austin, baseball is kind of a roller coaster, and they're going through their downturn right now. I'd expect them kind of water to find its level a little bit, so to speak.
Yeah, it's a big downturn, though. It really, really is. That's a huge, huge drop-off from where they started. And obviously, Shields is probably the first of many moves to come for this division, for all of the teams trying to stay on top of that division. Anthony Fenech joining us on his off day. It's been an off day for the Tigers as well. They trail 7-2 going into the bottom of the eighth right now against the Toronto Blue Jays. Last thing, we'll let you go. Who's the best team in the American League?
Best team in the American League, Texas Rangers. I picked them to go to the World Series, and I mean they just have a lot of talent on that team. It was funny to see Ken Giles, the Astros closer, kind of popping off about how, you know, they have more talent. Well, the Astros are flawed. You can see that when the Tigers played them, but I think the Rangers, top to bottom, they just got Yu Darvish back. I think they're clearly the best team in the American League. And then they just got young reinforcements all across the board. They got Nomar Mazara, who's a AL Rookie of the Year candidate. You got Jurickson Profar, who came up when Rougned Odor was out. He's been playing well. He's kind of put him in a position where they can't send him down. And then, you know, if an injury strikes, you know, Joey Gallo is still in the minor league there. Prince Fielder's really been struggling, though, which is really surprising to me. I mean, he has just been really bad since the Tigers traded him. So I would expect him to bring it up a little bit. I mean, he's not this bad, but I have a sneaky suspicion that there might be something wrong physically with Fielder still, but I think for my money, the Rangers are the best team they are.
Yeah, Prince Fielder is a mystery. I mean, seriously, what could have gone wrong? What could have happened? It's got to be an injury of some kind. I mean, how does it?
I mean, what about that trade? What about that trade for the Tigers? I mean, they got Ian Kinsler, who's playing at a, you know, at a prime level right now, still, and it has been for the last 3 years after they got rid of Fielder. I mean, that was
one of the best all around players and hitters in the American League, if not all of baseball. That's a tremendous trade. Yeah, Prince, just FYI for those who don't know, Prince is hitting 190 right now with 3 home runs and 29 RBIs. While the RBI total is decent and respectable, certainly not enough power and obviously just not enough contact and base hits for Prince Fielder. So, yeah, that is a great trade. It's one of those things where you look at it and you say, boy, Dave Dombrowski really fleeced somebody. What a great thing for the Tigers. Wait a minute, he's not the guy anymore. He's not able to fleece anybody anymore or make deals like that anymore. That's no knock on Mr. Avila, but time will tell whether or not you know, they're able to continue that. All right, Anthony, great stuff as always. We appreciate your Tigers update. Enjoy your day off. You said you're heading to New York for the weekend?
Yep, I am.
All right. Well, enjoy your trip. Be safe, and we'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
Bob, Robert, Jim, James. See you guys.
All right, buddy. Buddy, thank you. Buddy and brother. That's buddy when you're putting those two together. All right, buddy. All right, good stuff from Anthony Fenech there. Yeah, I mean, I just and by the way, I think he's right about the Rangers. It is odd that they are playing as well as they are and not getting production from a guy like Fielder. But they do have the best record in the American League. I, of course, would not count out the Orioles in that question that I asked of him. As they lead in the American League East by a relatively comfortable margin. Not that anything's comfortable. It's only a half game. But, I mean, just they and the Red Sox are up, obviously, by 4.5 over the Blue Jays, the next highest contender. 6.5 over the Yankees. The Rays are 8 back. But I think the Orioles are for real. And I'll be honest with you. I mean, he might be right when he says that the American League Central just isn't a very good division. Usually when you see a bunch of teams competing for a division championship, you say it's a strong division. Look at all of the, you know, the strength there. It's not one good team but a bunch of bad teams, so it's a good division, unless they're just all equally bad. But I will say this. I tend to lean toward, well, I guess I lean toward both of what our two writer friends have said in the last 2 days. The Tigers are the most talented team in the division, especially when you look at the lineup. It's a tremendous offensive lineup that ought to be able to pound the majority of teams into submission if they even get adequate pitching, starting and bullpen. They are the most talented. But I think what Zach Meisel said the day before is pretty accurate, too, and that is the Indians might not be as talented as, for example, the Tigers, but they have fewer flaws. They have fewer fatal flaws, things that will cost them games, cost them position in the standings, et cetera, for long periods of time. When you have fewer flaws, you are much less likely to go on the extended 19 games and 25 games losing streak that a team like the White Sox are on right now. You can be extraordinarily talented and go into those streaks if you've got flaws that you can't fix. But if you have, again, the fewer flaws or fewer issues that can linger over and over and over again, despite one part of your team playing well, you can avoid those long losing streaks. And if you do, then maybe the Indians are. So, looking at it right now, your division leaders are the Orioles in June. Obviously, it's June 8th. We still have a month before the All-Star break and everything else. But Orioles, Indians, and Rangers are your division leaders. And the Tigers are now tied for second, by the way, before today's loss, which is about to be completed. But they're tied for second. The Red Sox would obviously be the second-best record, or I'm sorry, the best second-place record if things were to end right now.
Now, the interesting thing with, you know, or real quick, Bob, the interesting thing with the division, I'm really liking the flaws argument because I don't think this division is necessarily bad, especially if we're not counting the Minnesota Twins right now.
Yeah.
But nobody's outstanding. Nobody's on the level of Texas or the Cubs in the National League in this division. And that's why what you see, even with the White Sox fall off, they're still, as of right now, at the 500 mark. So you got four of the five teams at or above the 500 mark at this moment. So I'm really liking, you know, the flaws argument, you know, going on right now when you're trying to evaluate these four or maybe three teams if Chicago continues to fall. It makes it a more interesting division, though, going down the stretch. And what's really going to be important is your record against the division because of how baseball's schedule is weighed that way. And right now the Indians are better than anybody in this division playing inside the division.
Agreed. And then I think that's very well said. I too am kind of being more swayed by the flaws argument, if you will, than I am the most talented argument. And time will tell. You know, injuries are obviously going to play a big role in that too. You know, the injury, for example, to Danny Salazar, which is pushing his start back to Sunday, forced the Indians to bring up Cody Anderson for a spot start. And he has been flat out awful. He was awful last night. He got banged around by the Mariners. And of course, where do they sit now? They don't sit, but their six game losing streak has come to an end because of those kinds of things. So, you know, flaws in injuries and depth obviously play a big, big role in how this whole thing is going to play itself out. All right. We can talk a lot of baseball and will, obviously, in the next 2-3 months as we push on through the summer. But I want to take a time out now and get back to basketball. Why? The National Basketball Association NBA Championship is up for grabs. All right, that's not accurate. It's not up for grabs. That would indicate a jump ball. That would indicate an equal opportunity for two teams to take it. That's not true. the Cavaliers have a much, much, much tougher row to hoe, if you will, in order to get to that title. They've got to defeat a Warriors team that has beaten them seven straight times, four times in the next five. It sounds like it's absolutely impossible. And guess what? It is absolutely impossible unless the Cavaliers' all-time superstar starts acting like an all-time superstar. And LeBron James, based on his own description of his responsibilities here, does not really appear to be ready to act like an all-time superstar. When told about Phil Jackson saying LeBron needs to be more like Michael, meaning be more selfish in order to dominate and take over and win his team a must-win game like this, LeBron James was very matter-of-fact, saying, I'm not Michael, nor am I Muhammad Ali. I'm a different cat. I'm just me.
Not Michael. I'm not Ali. I'm not nobody else that's done so many great things for sport. I am who I am, and, you know, if I'm able to go out and put together a game like that, it wasn't because I was possessed. It's because I worked on my craft all season long, and, you know, that's the result of it. So.
Guess what? It's true. He has got to work more on his craft if he is going to get this done, because he's going to have to be able to score the ball from the outside, at least a little bit. He's going to have to score the ball from a jump shot position instead of from a constant driving position, because the Warriors know it. They're laying back off of him. They're saying, we dare you to beat us from out there, and if you do, we'll deal with that then, but we're not going to let you just come in here like a locomotive and score 35 on us inside the paint. Until he's able to stretch the defense a little bit with his own jump shots, that is going to be his challenge. And it's the Cavaliers' challenge starting tonight in Game 3. Rick Nolan will join us with a little NBA Finals Game 3 preview coming up after the top of the hour Sports Center, which is right now on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
I think for me to go out and be who I am and play as true to the game and as hard as I can and try to lead this team is who I am, not anybody else. I'm not Michael, I'm not Ali, I'm not nobody else. Done so many great things for sport. I am who I am. You know, if I'm able to go out and put together a game like that, it wasn't because I was possessed. It's because I've worked on my craft all season long, and, you know, that's the result of it.
It's going to be a great atmosphere. Our fans are unbelievable, and I can't wait to get out there tonight. I'm going to do whatever it takes to help our team win this ball game. I mean, I got to do a job of trying to get my guys some looks. When I attract a double team or I attract guys in transition to get those guys going, it's 50-50. Those guys have to get themselves going as well.
What changes for you guys if Kevin is not able?
Next man up.
He has to make sharp, quick moves, and he understands that. But we need Kyrie to be aggressive. So he's a scorer. He's a special player. He has the best handle in the NBA, so he's able to play ISO basketball. But he's got to make quick decisions, and he understands that.
The only thing this way is going to go is if, you know, myself and Brown, we have to will our ways to their defense. You know, they're doing a lot of switching, a lot of things that to make us uncomfortable, which we haven't necessarily seen throughout the season. So for us, it's just about preparation.
We're not foreign to hostile environments, especially this year, everywhere we've went. You know, it's been crazy. You know, it's been sold out everywhere we went. Everybody, fans are super loud, you know, with the season that we're having. So, you know, we just got to come in here with the even greater focus than we had at home and block the crowd out as much as you can.
Now, you think about this playoff series, the Houston series, I didn't play. We still had a legit chance in the last 2 minutes to get that job done. So that was kind of just a missed opportunity. Portland series kind of the same way. And then last series, we just got dismantled in 3 and 4 on the road. And it was more a situation where we kind of beat ourselves with turnovers. The details of the game plan that we knew we needed to correct. We hope we can figure that out for tomorrow. This is a hostile environment for sure, and one that we remember from last year.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Some of the principal voices of the men who will decide the NBA championship, arguably right here or right there in Cleveland, Ohio tonight. Game number 3 goes from Oakland to Cleveland, and it is quite frankly a championship night for the Cavaliers, insofar as the fact that if they lose this one, they are going to lose the championship. If they do win it, they, of course, still have an opportunity. We have seen, as you just heard Steph Curry talked about, they lost games 3 and 4 to Oklahoma City, and all looked terrible for them. And, of course, it took a furious comeback for them to win the Western Conference Final. Can the Cavaliers do something similar after being smoked by 48 points, an NBA record in games 1 and 2 out in Oakland? Can they win games 3 and 4? Can they do it impressively? Can they do it comfortably and really make this a series again? or are the Warriors just too good? And if they are that good tonight, even without the Splash Brothers being the Splash Brothers in either of the first two games, quite frankly, winning as comfortably as they did, if they are that good and Game 3 goes to the Warriors tonight, it is championship over. It's just a matter of whether pride gets the Cavaliers a game in this series or not. Joining us now to break it down as we return to the NBA Finals conversation is Rick Noland, our good friend from out Cleveland way. He is indeed covering the Finals tonight, has been doing this for the Cavaliers, not the Finals anyway, but the Cavaliers for some 30 years now. And Rick, always so pleased to have you joining us right here on The Ticket. How are you, sir?
I'm doing better than the basketball team right up the road.
Rick, it freaked me out when I said it this way last hour. I'll say it to you because it just sounds so daunting. But, I mean, you know, reality is what reality is. They have lost seven straight times to the Golden State Warriors. And now to win the championship, they must beat them 4 out of 5. That's just monumental. It's too hard to wrap your mind around and say, okay, they can do that.
It is. And, you know, some PR types are trying to point to the fact that they're unbeaten at home in the playoffs. Well, the fact remains they've lost their last three home games to Golden State by an average of 21 points. So I think that Quicken Loans Arena is going to be some kind of magic elixir for all that ails them is a little foolhardy. I do expect them to play better. I think if they're going to win a game in this series, Bob, and I'm talking about a game right now, it's real hard for me to see them winning this series. But if they're going to win a game, it would have to be tonight. But they're going to have to play a lot better in so many different areas that it's not going to be easy. They need Bron to be Bron, and Kyrie's got to learn how to score and do it quickly and effectively without being what we called in grade school a ball hog. Basically, and they've got to figure out a bunch of things defensively because Golden State's getting a lot of easy shots. So the task is large. I won't be shocked if they win tonight, but I certainly won't be shocked if they lose either.
Rick, a couple of different elements of what you just said to follow up on. Let's start with just this one. You said they got to fix some things defensively, and they obviously have to fix some things offensively. Which is the bigger issue for them after 48 points of differential in two games combined? Is it the offense being as inefficient as it is? LeBron not being, you know, maybe as selfish as he needs to be as a bona fide superstar, or the team not being in sync offensively? Or is it the fact that it just doesn't seem to matter how much they switch? Maybe they're over-switching? I don't know. But whatever it is, they just seem to have no defensive answers in terms of ways to slow down, let alone stop, Golden State. Which is the bigger challenge, scoring on this team or stopping them from scoring?
I'm a little bit in the minority here among the media in Northeast Ohio, Bob. And I think part of it is because it's become fashionable to always point to defense is why you win and lose games. But let's be honest, it doesn't matter how well they play defense if they're going to score 77 or 89 points against this team. They're not going to play it well enough to win with those totals. So I think they got to be better offensively. And I think what I would like to see them do if I was a Cavs fan, I think LeBron came into this series thinking that maybe he was going to get a little more help, or he had to do a little less because he had Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving, and now they don't have Love. So I would like to see LeBron come out tonight and be ultra-aggressive from an individual standpoint from the opening tip. Quit worrying about getting his teammates going and get himself going from the get-go. He didn't score in the first quarter Sunday. Did take 5 shots and missed them all, but I think if he picks up a head of steam, gets to the hole, gets some free throws, it kind of helps him become a better player all around. It also, you know, in an odd sort of way, it even seems to make him a tiny bit better mid-range shooter. And right now, Golden State is daring him to shoot 15, 16, 17 footers, and he's not taking them. So, you know, he comes out and has a 12, 14 point first quarter, maybe those shots start to come down too. And you know, maybe he goes for 40-plus, and maybe that's enough. And you know, maybe Kyrie joins in, and they get a little something from somebody else, be it JR or Channing Frye or someone. But I think at this point, he can't rely on anybody else to do it. He's got to go out and do the utmost he can individually and try to bring the rest of the team along with him.
Rick Noland is our guest as we break down Game 3 of the NBA Finals. And, boy, I tell you what, I really wish we could pick up the the energy level here. Rick, you and I both, and I say
yeah,
this
I don't have
critical
any.
Of you, but we both
yeah,
seem like we're doing
any.
A post-mortem already, you know?
Yeah, and I almost feel like that, Bob. And I picked the Cavs to win in this series, and right now I'm really scratching my head trying to think of what it was I was thinking or what I saw. When I did that, because I knew the Warriors were great. I'm one of the few people around here who didn't think they got too much credit. I thought they deserved all they got. Maybe I didn't realize just how great they were. And you know, maybe this is just a reminder of just how bad the Eastern Conference is.
Bingo. That was going to be one of my other questions to you. I talked about that a little bit yesterday. You know, we've all known it. I think even people in the East have said, you know, yeah, the West is better, but by a lot. When you look at this,
hot.
I mean, you know, Detroit, Atlanta, Toronto being the path for the Cavs, and they went through it very convincingly,
yeah.
12-2, and boy, oh boy. But you know, you ask yourself if the Cavs were in the West and playing
right.
on a regular basis against the Thunder, Warriors, Grizzlies, Clippers, Spurs, and Blazers. You wonder where they'd fit, where they'd be seated. The West is just, honest to goodness, that much better.
Yeah, and, you know, Golden State coming back from that 3-1 against Oklahoma City, it just seems to kind of started a wave of momentum that the Cavs have been unable to stop. You know, the other thing, too, and this isn't any great words of wisdom, but Golden State has a ton of guys and Iguodala and Sean Livingston and Draymond Green, Klay Thompson. They can play. They're very good at both ends of the floor. The Cavs have a lot of guys who are specialists, some of them being defensive-oriented, like Shumpert and Delly. And some of them being offensive, like JR and Channing Frye. They don't have too many guys outside of LeBron that can really affect the game at both ends of the floor. And I think that becomes more and more apparent, with each game.
Yeah, I would not disagree with that at all, and that is something that makes the Warriors so dangerous, and it seems like it's not just a couple of guys that play both ends. It seems like that incredibly deep bench. You know, those T-shirts they wear, the Cavs wear All In is their playoff slogan, and the Warriors wear Strength in Numbers, and it's real. It's legit. It's not just a slogan. They are so deep. They can go into that bench 7, 8, 9 deep and bring guys in, both of you know, who can indeed, as you point out, impact the game on both ends of the floor, and that's a big advantage that Steve Kerr really enjoys here.
Yeah, they actually can go 11 deep. When I did my matchups for this series, I limited it 9 for each team and based it largely on what I saw from the previous series. And I didn't even include Leandro Barboso in my 9 players because he barely saw the floor against OKC. And he's been phenomenal in this series through 2 games. He's 10 of 12 from the field. I included Maurice Fates, who is not a factor at all in this series. But you know, they can even go to Andy as their 11th in this thing. And the Cavs right now, you don't really know what you're getting from any of these guys beyond LeBron and maybe Kyrie and Kevin Love. There's not anybody they can say, hey, this guy I know is going to give me 8 to 14 points tonight, because that 8 might be 2, judging by the way the bench has played in the first 2 games. I wish I had more answers for them, but, you know, they're not going to become a player they aren't suddenly tonight right. in game three. A lot of people think play Mozgov. To me, that's grasping in an 85-inch straw at this point. He hasn't been any good all year. I don't know what he's really going to do for you in game three. Bogut's not going to stop blocking shots because Mozgov's on the floor. I don't know. I would start Richard Jefferson tonight, personally, in place of Kevin Love. I'd probably also start Iman Shumpert in place of JR because I think JR is just lost at this point in the series. I think three is probably a little too many lineup changes to make, but I wouldn't totally rule out playing Channing Frye instead of Tristan Thompson tonight. I look at it like this, Bob. They have nothing to lose other than two more games. So they may as well try something.
You know, I don't disagree. Normal conventional wisdom would say not to do what you're talking about.
Yeah, it looks like you're panicking, but
what's that?
You have to do something.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but the old adage, desperate times call for desperate measures. And I'm not sure I wouldn't go a little differently than what you are. And just go big. And I mean, just slow the game down, change the flow altogether, start Mozgov with LeBron and I don't know, Tristan on the front line, and maybe even start Delly at the point and move Kyrie to the two and let him, do his thing for more of the wing rather than the point, and just pound the ball up the court slowly, change the game, try to slow down the slashers for Golden State because obviously the way they played it in the first two games has led to a minus 48. So what else other than just trying something different?
Yeah, if you're going to go that route, you have to go exactly against the way that Ty Lue keeps saying he wants them to play. So that leads me to believe that they can't play Mozgov, because if they do, they have to play like they did last year, where they're trying to keep the possessions in this game as low as possible, virtually walk the ball up the floor with every opportunity, put it in LeBron's hands and say, here, score as many points as you can. If you miss, we're going to try to have our biggest players crash the boards and get us another shot at it. And we're going to try to limit Golden State to one shot at the other end.
Right.
And hopefully it's in a half-court offense and not in transition. I'm not against that. I'm not against using Mozgov if that's the way they're going to play, but everything I'm hearing Ty Lue say tells me that they're not going to play that way, and if they're not, then I don't know how much Mozgov can really help you.
Rick Nolan joining us, Cavaliers beat writer, trying to figure out what the Cavs can do and might do tonight to win Game 3 and stay alive in this series. I want to go back to LeBron, and you talked about selfishness or ball hogging or whatever you want to call it, but not in a negative way. It's just that this is what a star sometimes has to do.
Yes.
And that's what Phil Jackson said. Phil Jackson, of course, who coached Mike, started to reference the 93 Eastern Conference Finals in which Michael was down zero games to two. And he found motivation in a New York Times article ripping him for not being focused because he spent an off day in the series at a casino in Atlantic City. And the Bulls won four straight after that article. He averaged 32.2 points per game for the series. And Phil said it's just he needed something to say, go be you, go out of anger, out of feeling disrespected or whatever it is, go and take over. And Phil Jackson said this is something that LeBron needs to do. Put his cape on, find something that makes you say, I'm going to go take over this series now, and I'm good enough as the best player in the world to do that. LeBron responded to that, as I'm sure you're aware, because you were probably there. But
yes,
I want to play it for those who didn't hear it, Rick, and then get your response to that. Here's LeBron's response to Phil saying, hey, go be more Jordan-esque and find a way to take this whole thing over.
Not Michael. I'm not Ali. I'm not nobody else that's done so many great things for sport. I am who I am, and, if I'm able to go out and put together a game, like that, it wasn't because I was possessed. It's because I worked on my craft all season long, and that's the result of it. So, Phil's a great coach. Mike's a great player, but I'm who I am.
I'm who I am, and I'm not Mike, he said, and I'm not a guy like Ali, where I just go and do these things in that way. What's your response to LeBron saying that's not what I'm going to be able to do, or I'm going to try?
I don't know, because as I was listening to that, Bob, I'm not even sure what that meant, quite honestly. He did play exactly that way last year when he was the only hope they had. And I think after the way his team got beat in the first two games this series, I don't know how he can not think that, hey, I'm the only hope we have right now, too. I'm the best player on the planet, the most dominant player on the planet. I would think that he would think that he has to go out and play that way. You know, if he flops miserably and shoots 8 of 32, so be it. But I don't see how they're really going to win if he's not a tremendous force in this game tonight, and a tremendous force from the beginning of it to the end of it.
Can I ask you something that's extraordinarily cynical? I'm wondering if that isn't exactly what he's thinking. That if he goes and tries to do what Phil Jackson said he needs to do, and others have said, and you suggested at the beginning of our chat, that he needs to go out there and be more selfish, needs to establish himself. It's nice to try to get other guys involved, but now it's time to go out there and do your dominant thing. If he tries that and fails at it, that it will make him look much, much worse, as everybody in this sport right now, everybody, all of the analysts on the national level, all of the national writers, guys like you at the local level, I don't know if you've actually written this, but everybody is talking about LeBron's legacy, especially if they get blown out in this finals, and he falls to 2-5 in NBA championship finals, and does so in embarrassing fashion. Is he thinking, I wonder, if I go out there and say, yeah, I know I got to take over now, and then goes 8 for 32, that it doesn't look more awful, whereas if he goes out and just kind of takes his 19 shots like he did in the first couple and puts it on a lot of other guys and they fail, it doesn't look so bad for him? And that's cynical, I know, but I'm just wondering. Thoughts?
Yeah. It's impossible for me to know. To your point, I guess, you know, what are we all thinking right now? And that's that Golden State is so much better than the Cavs that you can't really throw all the blame on LeBron because they're playing one of the greatest teams in NBA history. Mm-hmm. But perhaps part of the reason it's looked like that is because LeBron personally hasn't done enough to affect that. So I don't know.
Kind of a catch-22. I mean, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I certainly would have. Bob, if he shoots 30 times a night, I won't have a problem with that, provided they're not some of the three-pointers he's taken already in this series. Take shots, drive into the hole, be aggressive. He's even struggled finishing at the rim. This whole series has just kind of perplexed me.
Ironically, Rick, you know, the struggle here is what you just said. You know, if he takes 30 shots, I'm okay with it as long as they're not some of those threes he has taken. And yet, the reason I think he has struggled to finish at the rim in the first two games in this series is they know he can't hit from out there.
Yeah.
They're laying off of him, and every drive he makes, he's being contested by as many as six arms. You know, two that belong to Bogut coming over to help from the weak side, two for Iguodala, and two from, I don't know, Clay or Draymond or somebody swiping, smacking at the ball, getting strips, or fouling him and saying, we'll take our chances at the line, or just forcing misses. I mean, they know that he's not shooting from the outside. He was 5 for 14 away from 5 feet or outside of 5 feet. And, you know, so honestly, if he's going to score inside, he has to hit a couple of jumpers just to get them to step out.
Well, yeah, and that's the shot I won't mind seeing him taking when he's 16 feet from the basket with, at best, a hand in his face. The defender's not even close enough where he's going to block the shot or do much more than token contest it. You have to shoot some of those, Bob. When you have four other defenders watching you dribble the ball at that portion of the floor, all waiting to help as soon as you go to the basket, you've got to be able to knock a few of those down. And to knock some down, you have to take some. And they're not difficult looks. He's basically facing the basket while he's doing so, you know, in rhythm, and won't pull up and shoot it. So you've got to be able to make that. There's no way around it. If you don't, they are never going to alter the way they play. There was a sequence in game two where LeBron was dribbling a little bit inside the three-point arc, went around two screens going left, and it was being defended by Draymond Green on the first screen. On the second screen, he was being defended by Andre Iguodala, and after the second one, actually, he was being defended by Klay Thompson. So they had three different guys between 6'7 and 6'8 all guard him without him really making any move. They just merely switched, and all three of them basically said, LeBron, you can shoot this shot anytime you want. I'm going as far under that screen as possible. Shoot it if you will. And he didn't. And I think he has to be able to make that shot to open up the rest of his game. And then all of a sudden, you know, driving lanes open up. But the other idea is, I wrote this in jest the other night on my Facebook. When the guy Kyrie Irving is guarding in this series shoots the basketball, he's shooting 78% through two games. So perhaps they could have Kyrie get a little close to LeBron on offense, and he could pretend Kyrie's guarding him, and then just the shot will go in. That might be the best I have for you right now, Bob.
Thank you for reminding
snark and cynicism. So
thank you for reminding me of why I need to check your Facebook page more often. It's classic. Kyrie, get over near LeBron on offense, will you please? A much better chance at it. Last thing, Rick, on Kyrie, you wrote about this today. It's an interesting thing on the offensive end for him. You know, the Cavs need, it's weird, you know, we're sitting here saying LeBron needs to be more ball dominant. He needs to, not ball dominant,
right,
just offensively dominant. He needs to get more shots up. He needs to do that. But they can't win without a good game from Kyrie. And Kyrie said, essentially, I am not very good when I'm not being aggressive. If I'm being passive and laid back on my offense, I don't do very well. I've got to be aggressive, which means he does need the ball in his hands, and that kind of is counter to what we just discussed with LeBron's needs here, or what the Cavs need LeBron to do. So you called for it today in your column, and I thought it was interesting. They need middle ground here. They need a middle ground between a passive Kyrie and an aggressive Kyrie. They got to find a way for him to be aggressive enough to get points and get production without, you know, taking the ball out of LeBron's hands as often as possible.
You know, I thought in game one, I thought Kyrie played pretty well, 7 of 20 shooting, 22 shooting, notwithstanding. But, mm-hmm. you know, there were some instances when he dominated the ball too long and took them out of the flow. So it seemed like he went completely to the other side of the pendulum swung completely to the other side in game two. And he basically said non-verbally, well, if you don't want me to dominate the ball, I'll just stand over here and do nothing most of the game. And that's what he did. And obviously that's not what they want, but he scored the first 4 points for them, I think, in game two and had 6 the rest of the game. And for most of that game, he wasn't even awful or even bad. He was just completely uninvolved in anything. Obviously, that's not what Ty Lue meant. So he's a guy who could be helped greatly by a good start tonight. He's struggling, though, off the dribble mightily. I think I saw 8 of 9 in this series when he catches and shoots, and 4 and 27. Off the dribble, which we think of as one of Kyrie's strengths.
Yeah.
That's how he gets his shots. So, you know, they put a lot of length on him, too. Steph's guarded him a little more than I thought through two games, but when they go to Livingston or Clay, it's, you know, he's having to change the trajectory of his shot a little bit. So They need the very best Kyrie tonight, not the one that doesn't even have an assist until the fourth quarter of garbage time.
I really thought he would flourish in this matchup. Coming off of what he did offensively and defensively to Jeff Teague, primarily in the Atlanta series, and what he did, with the exception of Game 3 and part the first half of Game 4 in the Toronto series, he took it to Kyle Lowry and the Toronto guards offensively and defensively, shutting Lowry down for long periods. I thought he is playing about the best he has ever played, and he's gearing up for Steph. He wants this matchup so badly, and my goodness, it could not be going worse for him. I don't understand.
Yeah, I thought so too, and I was fairly encouraged by his play for the most part of Game 1 until the end, and then it kind of got away from him. But there was a big step back in Game 2. Now, he's a guy that sometimes maybe the home crowd will help him. But he needs to get going early, too. You know, that obviously LeBron and Kyrie have to carry this team tonight, and even that might not be enough. But if both don't play well, I'm fairly certain that it won't be enough. So,
have we figured out yet why J.R. Smith just came?
Oh, I have no idea. You know, of all the people that you would think would tighten up in the NBA Finals, J.R. just by his actual lack of thought sometimes on the basketball court would be the last person I would think that would happen to. But I wouldn't even start him tonight, Bob. If he's not giving you offense, you have a lot better options on defense than him. So
agreed. I totally agree. And then maybe no coming clue. Off the bench without, you know, whatever pressure he feels. And I agree with you because he's a guy with no conscience. It's what makes him so
exactly.
Effective.
And all of a sudden, he's not even shooting the ball. He's not even missing shots.
Yeah, what's he taking? 9 shots in the 2 games, I think? 3 in the first,
yeah,
6 in the second?
Yeah, he scored 8 points in 2 games, and he's taken 9 shots, and I think 7 of them have been threes. I did some math. He was averaging more than 7 three-point attempts a game in the first 3 rounds of the playoffs and shooting 46%. He's taken 9 shots total in the first 2 games of this series and scored 8 points.
Yeah,
so
it is remarkable. And, I, you know, again, he's a guy who just has no conscience. If he is 1 for 10, he's still jacking up shot number 11 because he knows he
yeah.
can go 6 for his next 6, and that's just the way he plays, and he just won't do it. And it's a mystery. Rick, great stuff. I appreciate it. Dare I ask you to pick tonight? Are they going to win Game 3? I know we both have been a little bit under the the energy level because we're a little depressed here. Are you calling for a win here, or do you think that this is actually going to be a Golden State step toward a sweep?
Let me just say it this way: if they are going to win, it's going to be tonight, but even if they do, I don't think this series is going more than 5 games. And if they don't win tonight, I think it's over Friday night. How's that?
I think that's fair enough. And I can't really dispute it, as depressing as it is to say so. Rick, great discussion. I really appreciate it. I wish we had better better atmosphere and attitude here going into Game 3. Maybe they'll give us a reason for optimism the next time we talk. Hopefully they'll get it done tonight,
yeah.
and we still have something else to talk about.
I was going to say if there is a next time we talk.
Right. That's exactly what I mean. You know, if they get this one done and God willing, things turn around and maybe the home crowd is some sort of magic elixir for them, then who knows? Then the possibility is there. But it's 48 minutes away before we can even have that conversation.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, my friend. Great talking to you as always. Keep up the great work. Hopefully we'll chat again soon. All right.
All right. Anytime.
There he is, Rick Nolan, joining us, breaking down Game 3 of the NBA Finals. A very, very negative vibe that I think a lot of people are feeling right now. I don't like that feeling. I didn't want to have that going into this series. And a lot of people say, hey, remember, a series doesn't start until the road team wins. And if both teams take care of business on their home court, we're 2-2. Going into a 3-game series, and then anything can happen. But that starts with one at a time, which is tonight at the Q in Cleveland. All right, let me get a quick time out here. We'll come back. I want to take some phone calls. I got a few other things that we want to discuss with you as we continue the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 1065 The Ticket.
Indeed, that's what it is, an extravaganza. Thanks so much for being a part of the chat today. Good stuff by Rick Noland, as always. Did you feel it? You know, normally when we talk to Rick Cush, he's, you know, I don't want to say he's upbeat. He's not a fanboy. He's
right.
He's not a reporter who doesn't take his job as a reporter seriously. He's a beat writer. And while he, of course, pulls for the Cavaliers to win and wants them to win as a beat writer covering that team, you know, he doesn't go over the top. But he usually has, you know, some reasons for optimism. Let's phrase it that way without being over the top. And he just sounded defeated. He sounded defeated, and I know I do too, which is not what my plan was going into the series. I'm the one who played the Rocky music and said, you know, what's the theme? What's the theme of that speech? It's not about how hard you can hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. And if the Warriors hit the Cavaliers a couple of times and win the first two, if they land some body blows that are just painful as all get out, keep moving forward. No negativity, no quit, no stopping you. I said that before the series started, and here I am going into game three feeling like I've quit, feeling like I'm defeated, feeling like we can't move forward anymore.
Yeah, and the way those first two games happened, it certainly, you know, makes one feel that way, because, I mean, it's still hard for me to imagine that the Cavs were in a better position last year at this moment than they are at this. There's still part of me that finds that so hard to fathom, but the way those two games, it's easy to see, even if you're not trying to be a fanboy as you describe it, to kind of have this just ominous feeling about it, and it would get you down a little bit. You said something earlier that I keep thinking about too, and it's about the team in general and LeBron in their own separate ways. There's a pride element on this one tonight. Obviously, you know, we know the deal. If you go down 0-3, there's no coming back from that. Incidentally, all time 0-2 in NBA playoff history, 17-262. Incidentally, is what being down 0-2 ends up looking like.
Say that again.
If a team is down 0-2, they came back and won the series 17 times. They still lost 262 times.
Wow.
Oh, it's even worse. Since 2009, that number is 3-61.
The last time a team was down 0-2 in the NBA Finals and came back to win, do you know who it was?
It was, I know there was, that's only happened twice, and one of them I want to say was 77 Blazers over the Sixers.
That is true, but that was the old one.
Why can't I remember the
other one? The most recent one was much more recent, and it involved
Mavericks. Mavericks. No, the Heat beating the Mavericks.
Exactly.
This was the Shaq and Wade
Heat. In 2006, when Shaq and Wade were down 0-2, they came back and won that series. So. Because Shaq was quoted in talking about that. Look, and Shaq, by the way, taking no mercy or showing no mercy to Kevin Love or Kyrie Irving. He ripped both Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love for not pulling their weight as part of the big three to help LeBron James. And we all know Shaq has a bit of a fondness for LeBron. When he came to the Cavaliers back in 06, he said, or 06-07, or wait a minute.
No, it was 09-10. It was LeBron's last year in Cleveland on the first go-around.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Okay, because I just remember when he got here, he said, it's time for a ring for the king.
He was here to win a ring for the king.
The king.
I remember
exactly
that.
Exactly what it was. So anyway, he's ripping his running mates here as far as Irving and Love. He said, remember last year the storyline was, okay, Golden State, you won a championship, but that's because Kyrie and Kevin Love weren't playing. Now they're playing. Now you've got to play like you know how to play. And he said, they're not doing it, quite frankly. Kevin Love, this is Shaq talking, Kevin Love's getting punked by Draymond. He really is. This is in an interview with the AP. I hate to be the one to say it, but he has to step up. You can't let a guy do the muscle thing in your face, and you don't respond. So, you know, there's a lot of people who think that Kevin Love is, I don't want to go over the top here and say soft, but it's what people think. A lot of people think that he's less than physically aggressive enough to really assert himself and be the dominant player he can be.
And it's because of things like that, and now that he's out for Game 3, I'm noticing some on the national end are bringing up that should they have traded Andrew Wiggins for him argument again, which to me
that's stupid. Is
still silly. But real quick, the thing I wanted to say was...
I mean, hold on, before you say it, they might be right, in hindsight. But at the time, that would have been absolutely stupid to not make that deal, because Andrew Wiggins plays the same position that LeBron plays, by the way. He plays
right.
at three.
Right.
And number two, it is believed that he is, like most young players coming in after 1 year of college or out of high school, that he is a good 3 or 4 years away from being what he needs to be to help win a championship.
And I still feel that
and
way.
Love being a first-team All-NBA player coming in, playing a different position than LeBron, was absolutely the right thing to think. So,
yeah, not to mention the fact that one of the complaints when the deal was being made, if you recall, was, well, Love's a bad defender. When are rookies ever great defenders?
Amen.
At the same time.
That's a great point.
But circling back on something, too, with the pride thing, I find interesting, because we know where it is if it goes down 0-3. So to a small degree, you have to play with that extra sense of urgency and that pride. And when I'm going to be looking for that, because you know a lot of people will say, well, see if they have that pride and that energy in the first 5 minutes. Now, I'm not waiting for that. With these Warriors, they all, in any game they play, and even games they lose, there's always that point where they go on one of those Warrior kind of runs for a few minutes. You know, Curry and them make a bunch of threes. They get a couple of defensive stops, maybe another transition basket when they're going at 100 miles an hour. They always have one of those kind of runs. You want to talk about pride? I want to see how the Cavs respond when that run at some point happens tonight, because there will be at least one.
You want to see how the Cavs respond when the Warriors make a run, you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah,
that'll show me more pride than the, oh, wait, we'll see how the energy level in the first 5 minutes. I'm waiting for what happens when the Warriors go on one of those runs. Are they going to get dejected? The kind of things I saw in the first two games, which last time I saw it was in the first two games of the East Finals on the faces of the Toronto Raptors.
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. I would say this. When they kind of didn't answer that run with pride, or those runs with pride, in game two, and it looked like what a lot of people describe as saying they quit, which is a pretty big indictment. The one defense maybe of it is, and we said, was they recognize where they are. They recognize it's not their night. They're down 23. And if they quit, it's just a matter of, we're not going to bust everything we have here in what we know is a game we cannot win. Let's just regroup and regather and go home and start it over again. Now they are home. If a similar type of thing happens, such as, you know, the Warriors going on this big 19-5 run and, you know, starting to open up a 9-point lead that threatens to be double digits,
right,
and threatens to blow the game wide open again. If they go into one of those freeze modes then, and quit modes, if you will, or we recognize we can't win modes, or whatever the case, whatever you want to call it, then we'll know. There quite frankly is no pride on this team. There's no saving it up for the next game this time.
Because you don't, when you're down 0-3, it's never happened before, and especially in basketball, there's a reason.
And not just the 0-3 part, but again, the home part, you know.
There's
no, hey, look, you know, we weren't expected to come out here and win one of these two anyway. That's why they have home court advantage for the team with the best record. They won their two at home. We get it. But now we get to go back to our place where things are different. And if they go back and don't treat it as if it's different, and again, as you point out, don't show pride as the lead threatens to grow and explode on them, then like I said, then we'll know. And then we'll know that something has to change, by the way. I don't want to get into off-season prognostications about who stays and
who goes.
We'll
have time for that.
There will be time for that. And you know when that time will start? Literally is after the final gun tonight, if one of those things happens.
Yeah.
Not a loss, but if they don't answer a run and they let something get away from them and it looks like they're hanging their heads and they are not playing with max effort, that they've somewhat quit, if that happens, then yes, indeed, people are going to start talking immediately about what happened, and somebody has to be held to account. How can they show no pride in game three, a must-win game in their own building?
And this is on both fronts. This is on the Cavs in general as this unit, even if it's going to be sans Love tonight, as a unit, how they respond to that. And then LeBron himself, with even if he's telling us in public that he's not trying to worry about these things, and you know, he's not Michael, he's not Ali, like that clip we had earlier, somewhere in private, part of him is thinking about it, too. I got to believe that.
No doubt about it.
And that's why it's about both of them, LeBron individually and the team in general.
My hope with respect to LeBron and this whole thing about, you know, not liking the Jordan idea, or the comparison or the advice from Phil Jackson that he's got to put on the cape and take over. My hope is that he's playing a little possum here. The one thing he doesn't want to do is sit up there at that podium and get asked that question and say, absolutely right, I intend to take this game over. I intend to do whatever it takes to go out there and will my team to victory. Essentially telling the Warriors, triple team me, because I'm going to do it all. I'm hoping he's sitting up there playing possum and saying, no, that's not me. It's not what I do. I'm me. Mike is Mike. Muhammad Ali is Muhammad Ali. I still don't know why he brought the boxer into it, but I'm just me, and I'm going to do things my way. In the hope that maybe the Warriors will hear that and say it's more the same, and then maybe catches them off guard with a virtuoso performance that they aren't seeing coming. That's the only thing I can hope. Is that
does LeBron need to be game 507 at the Palace tonight?
Exactly. Yes, yes. Or even as Rick Nolan said, even any one of the games that he played last year without Kyrie and Kevin Love, in which he averaged 36 points and 13 rebounds and almost 9 assists. Even though he had to take it on high volume of shots. Take over the way you have taken over in the past, but maybe just, don't tell the other guys that I intend to take over. Maybe a little possum here. That's my silver lining. That's my positive, you know, maybe this is the answer we're looking for going into Game 3. That's all I can do. All right, that's it. Great chat today. Really enjoyed it. Thanks so much for listening, being a part of the show. We'll talk to you tomorrow with a recap of Game number 3 and a lot more tomorrow at 3 o'clock right here on the Extravaganza. Drive Time with Miller is coming up next on the...
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.